Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, November 28th. I'm Ray Graff. Today on the show, we talk about the great outdoors. Can you smell that? I think that's the outdoors. Today, we'll welcome back Jeremy Hurst. Jeremy serves as the Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Also with us is Angelina Ross, the DEC's Avian and Mammal Diversity Unit Leader. One of her focuses is the conservation of New York's spruce grouse population. We'll talk about that and anything else you want to talk about. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst, Angie Ross, your wildlife questions coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We discuss wildlife on the program. Today, we welcome back our friend Jeremy Hurst. Jeremy is the Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. He facilitates the research, the outreach, the management planning for New York's big game, small game, and fur-bearing wildlife. Previously, he coordinated New York's management programs for white-tailed deer, black bear, and moose management. Also with us today is biologist Angelina Ross, who serves as the DEC's Avian and Mammal Diversity Unit Leader in Albany, focused mainly on the conservation of endangered and threatened species. For the last 20 years, one of her focuses has been on the conservation of New York's spruce grouse population. For the last 3 years, she's been spearheading efforts to relocate spruce grouse individuals from Maine and Canada into New York to enhance the species' genetic diversity. Number to call here if you want to talk to these two about the outdoors, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst, Angie Ross, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Jeremy, how have you been? It's been a while. I think we got bumped the last time.
We did. You had your fun drive.
Oh, that's a good reason.
Yeah. It was a good reason.
And by the way, is today Tuesday?
Yeah.
It's Giving Tuesday. So if anybody wants to go to WAMC.org and make a pledge right now, it truly helps. Anyway, good to have you back on the show.
Always a pleasure.
Angelina Ross, you're the spruce grouse person. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Why, in your character, led you to be interested in spruce grouses?
Yeah, it was kind of weird, actually, because I had no idea what grouse were 25 years ago, and, you know, I was kind of introduced into all this stuff. I started off in school as a music major.
Really?
And yeah. So,
what's your axe?
Oh, it's the flute.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily an axe, but it's,
right.
Yeah.
I do play the guitar as well, but yeah, the flute was my main instrument.
So that led to the spruce grouse?
Yeah, totally. It makes sense, right? You know, flutes, songs, birds. Actually, not really.
they're interesting birds, though. I knew of the ruffled grouse, and then today I looked up the spruce grouse. It's a little smaller, and not that smart, I guess. They call them the fool hen.
They do call them the fool hen.
Why?
So they do not behave like ruffed grouse, and in the same way, you know, like, so a ruffed grouse will fly away from you, act more wary, I guess, and a spruce grouse is totally unwary. They rely on their cryptic coloration. You know, they kind of look like the forest.
Yeah, what color are they? The picture I saw it almost on the DEC site looked blue to me, but I'm a little colorblind.
So are you?
So
the backs of them, I guess, is kind of like a slaty blue color, but they're really brown, white. Males are black and white. They have red eye combs. So I had gone to I had done a class and learned about spruce grouse existing. I was like, oh my God, I have to work with this species.
But there aren't that many in New York, right?
No, there are not.
How many we have right now?
So the last estimates were in the mid-1990s. And see, it's really hard to get estimates of numbers of individuals of different species. So we have an estimate of number of populations that we have instead. And there's about 17 subpopulations in New York. But somebody before me found that there were 175 to 315 in mid-90s.
Okay.
We have fewer than that. Maybe now, half of that.
Birds, yeah. Not populations.
Birds, yeah. Right. But 17 small pockets.
And as I understand, they live sort of in evergreen forests.
Yes.
And is part of the problem that those forests are dwindling?
Yeah, so around the late 1800s, early 1900s, we had vast, you know, timber harvesting, vast areas were clear cut. And in uplands, those types of trees don't do that well. You know, from a clear-cut state, they don't regenerate like they would in wetter areas. Those species of black spruce, tamarack, they compete really well in wet areas, like in the lowlands. So that's what we have left, and that's what the birds are restricted to. They actually eat the boreal forest. They eat the needles of spruce and tamarack, so...
But
they have to be
not
there.
Mature trees? Is that part of the problem?
So it is part of the problem. We found my grad work early on. So I was working on my master's, and I was trying to figure out what to do. Why are these birds dwindling? And basically, in a nutshell, we found that middle-aged, a 40-year-old forest or younger was where these birds persisted.
I mean, I look at the map and sort of where they live. It's mainly in Canada, just on the sort of skirting the northern part of the U.S. right across. How many are in Canada? Or, I mean, is it a lot in Canada and just a few on the edge of the forest, basically?
Pretty much, yeah. There are probably a million or a million and a half in Canada. I mean, nobody really knows.
Right.
But those are the estimates, you know, that you can find online. But, yeah.
I guess my question is, why... do we need to bring them from Canada and Maine if there's a lot of them? They're just north, a little north of here.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what you value. You know, they're part of our heritage, our natural heritage, and we're the reason. So we clear-cut forests and we caused this problem. They were more plentiful in the early 1900s, and so we caused the problem. So I guess it's all in what you value.
But how do you fix the problem if those forests, now they're not connected, there are not as many of them, and these are part of the problems? How do you fix that problem short of, you know, you got to wait a long time for these trees to grow?
Yeah, exactly. So we're working with private landowners to manage so we're doing some timber harvesting. I mean, you probably know the Adirondacks, you can't work on state land and cut trees because it's forever wild. So we've over the course of many years, I've fostered relationships with private landowners and gotten to do some habitat management in these places. And I've also, we've done a bunch of population viability analysis modeling. So we found that we have enough areas left to sustain the population if we do a few things like translocate these birds and enhance their genetic diversity and then manage, X number of, 10 pockets of habitat, we should have spruce grouse for 100 years.
Okay, and you have brought how many in the last 3 years since you've begun moving them?
You know, that's a good question.
A lot or a few?
Yeah, so each year we bring back 50 and we're in year 3.
Okay.
But previous to that, before we just like went great guns and brought all these birds back, we did a little test. So we had a few years where we took just a handful of birds and put radio collars on them and tracked their movements to see if are they all going to go, you know, like the lynx did all the way back to Canada or try to get there, or are they going to hang around? And they did hang around. So once we had enough information to say we're good, we did the 5-year, and that's all, you know, population viability, you know, you model that and you can get target numbers of acres and, you know, numbers of birds.
You should tell them how you catch them.
Oh, you want to hear about that?
I thought they just walk up to you.
Yeah, some of them.
Yeah.
So we use a noose pole. So I buy these carbon fiber poles.
Yeah.
They use them for fishing. But they just plop they're like 43 feet long.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're great. They're super light. We make a noose out of weed whacker cord on the end. The birds, you know, we play a call, hope that we're in the right area, and a grouse comes out, and then they're so drunk on hormones that they don't notice that we're there, and you can get close enough to noose them.
In a very non-dangerous way,
yeah,
you're
noosing
them, right?
You do have to noose them around their neck.
You do.
But I've noosed probably 300 grouse, and Yeah.
That's scary.
I think I've only killed one.
No, I mean, I've heard tell that, I mean, some environmentalists have danced with these things, and they come right up to you. Why do you need to wrap them up?
Well, you know, they don't let you put a band on them. You can't just walk up to them and put a band.
To tag them, yeah.
And then put a radio. You know, we use necklace-style radios, so they're not that tame.
Yeah, Jeremy, before we take a break here, explain how you danced with a grouse.
Well, it was a surprise to me as well. But I was in the woods and encountered a blue grouse in Wyoming. And it was fairly similar to a spruce grouse. Very
gregarious.
Well, not as wary as ruffed grouse are. And so I saw it and was trying to move around a tree to get a closer view. And it was wary enough that it just danced around the opposite side of the tree. And then when I would reposition, it would dance around the other side. And we just went back and forth for a few minutes until that was the end.
You know what they call that? YouTube gold.
Yeah.
Did you get any video?
No.
No? All right, Zach, let's take a break here. And then we'll hit the phones or the emails. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Vox Pop on WAMC Outdoors today with the New York State DEC. Jeremy Hurst is here. Angelina Ross, 800-348-2551 is the phone number. And the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. This email came in from Susie in Saratoga. We just live north of Saratoga, south of Corinth. Bears sometimes take our neighbors' bird feeders or snoop for food in the trash. It's been so mild, we have not fed birds since last April. What is a safe range to assume we have sleeping bears or just wait until it's very, very cold? And that's from Susie in Saratoga.
Well, Susie, great question. Thanks for asking. And you're a good time of year to ask that question because bears should soon be entering into their dens for their winter sleep. And so we generally recommend that folks who want to feed birds don't do so except between December 1st and April 1st. Not all bears will be in the den in beginning of December, particularly if we have no snow cover. There's still opportunity for them to forage on remaining beech nuts and acorns and bird feeders from folks who aren't as conscientious as you. But yet they will be going into the den soon. And bears are pretty cool for how they den. Females who are going to give birth will go into the den first. And then the females that have young of year from last year will go into den second. So sequentially throughout the season. And then males, adult males, will go into den latest. And then they'll come out in the reverse order in the springtime.
So what happens exactly? What is hibernation exactly? If you stumbled upon a bear that is hibernating, could you wake it up? I mean, what's going on physiologically?
Probably if you walked up on a bear that was in its den, it would be looking at you.
Oh.
So it's not necessarily hibernating asleep, deep slumber. True hibernation, the species that do that will reduce their metabolism substantially, drop their heart rate, drop their breathing rate, drop their body temperature substantially. And so that process takes a while to recover from. When they come out to feed or wake in the early spring, there's a recovery time that's necessary for that hibernation. But bears go into more what's called a torpor. And so they do reduce their metabolism. They'll go 4 to 6 months without urinating or defecating or consuming any food.
All right, that's hibernation to me, but
well,
I guess not.
It's torpor. But the difference is they don't drop their body temperature. They don't drop their heart rate. Their breathing rate is pretty slow to begin with, but they don't go to the same extent as other hibernators. So they're ready to be mobile fairly quickly. And when we at times have done research projects where we've been capturing bears in their dens, we will chemically immobilize them in the den so we can take measurements on the bears or take measurements on the cubs. And almost invariably, the bear is awake and looking at you when you approach the den. And when you stick your head into the hole or into the tree cavity and look at the bear, it's looking right back at you.
Oh, yeah, you make the interns do that, I assume.
Yeah, the smallest one.
What critters actually fully hibernate?
Well, like woodchucks or chipmunks.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Does science know how they go about reducing their metabolism and breathing and body temperature without dying?
Well, I'm sure there's some smarter people than me that know more about it than I do, but bears in particular are really remarkable in this, and they're a subject of study from a lot of medical scientists who are trying to understand how the body physiologically handles that kind of metabolism deprivation. Because they don't lose any muscle mass. You know, if you and I lay in a bed for 2 weeks, our muscles would atrophy.
Yeah.
But bears don't have that. And they don't resorb calcium from their bones in the same way that we would if we weren't consuming any food. And so there's some really unique properties about bears that could be important for human medicine.
So, right. And so this is not a learned behavior over the course of evolution?
No. This is inherent in how bears were designed.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones here. 800-348-2551 is the number. Angelina Ross and Jeremy Hurst are here from the New York State DEC. All right, one more email and then phones. This is from Tom in Gardner, Mass. Deers have been coming closer and closer to our neighborhood. What can or should we feed them?
Well, I would say you shouldn't feed them. Now, if he's calling from Massachusetts, I'm not sure what the rules are there. But from New York standpoint, it's actually illegal to feed deer. And so what we recommend for folks who want to see wildlife is to promote plants in their environment, in their yard, in their woods that are helpful for deer, to plant and cut trees even. So deer will, in the wintertime, consume the new growth from trees that were growing this last year.
Yes.
And so cutting down large trees, allowing new growth, young forest to perpetuate, creates habitat for deer.
We have been really good to the deer in my backyard. It's a buffet. Let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Gene in Duanesburg. Gene, you're on.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I have lived, I have 15 acres. I've lived here for 40 years. I have never seen a pheasant. And when I was younger, we used to see them all the time. What happened to them?
Well, Gene, the habitat's changed. And so pheasants are a species that really needs a lot of grassland habitat, and we don't have much of that in New York. Specifically in your area, there are hay fields and some abandoned farm fields, goldenrod fields and such, but not good fields that would be conducive to grout or to pheasant survival. So we have a pheasant release program in the state where we raise and release pheasants to support some hunting activities. We have had some efforts to explore whether or not we could perpetuate a wild population in portions of western New York. That project largely didn't materialize into success, and so our efforts there towards keeping wild pheasants alive don't seem to be working. And so at this point, we don't have much optimism for pheasants in New York other than as a species that we can stock and release. And even amongst those birds, their overwinter survival is very, very low.
Gene, thanks a lot for the call. Staying on birds for a minute, eagles were really decimated by DET. Was it DET?
DDT.
DDT, yep. In the 70s. And I don't know how low that population got, but New York and other states have done a hell of a job bringing these birds back. Getting back to the grouse, the spruce grouse for a minute, Angie, you got a couple hundred up there now. What's a good target population? I mean, how many would you like to see?
Oh, man. I would like to see a spruce grouse behind every tree trunk, but that's not going to happen. So we hope to see somewhere in the range of 20 subpopulations.
Yeah.
You know, and we're at 17 or so. We were down to 10, you know, but we're trying to move that needle there to increase our populations. So
how much movement is there between subpopulations?
There's not actually that much. It depends on how close the subpopulations are. If they're within a couple of kilometers, then there's some movement. Hmm. But generally, some do disperse. And, you know, so when they're young, they move into a neighboring population and they stay there. And some go and spend the winter there and then come back. It's the weirdest thing. Huh. I don't know.
So there is some genetic mixture amongst the populations.
Yeah, I'm sorry, say that again.
You have some genetic mixture amongst the subpopulations.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is. Yeah.
Why is that important, diversity, genetic diversity?
Well, you know, if everything is the same, if you have inbreeding, you can have inbreeding depression, and that could affect It could affect the quality of the eggs or the number of the eggs that are laid or the survivorship of the young, and you need young to keep the population going. So that's one of the main concerns there.
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. Jeremy Hurst and Angelina Ross from the New York State DEC join us. To Stone Ridge we go. Scott, you're on.
Hey, well, you actually asked my question, which just proves what a great show host you are.
You see?
I was wondering, how do you know with the spruce grouse, how do you know when it's time, when you've got enough relocated and it's time to sit back and see what happens?
So we're following Sorry, Scott.
That's okay.
I'm all excited
here. Predators follow them. Yeah, I was wondering, do predators follow them?
They must be easy prey.
I mean, they're pretty invisible. It's pretty difficult when you are following a radio-collared grouse. It's very difficult to find them, even though they're right above you in the tree. There's been days that we've gone out with our radio gear and, the bird is right in front of us and you can't see it. I mean, granted, I'm not trying to eat the thing.
Right.
And other, like coyotes and, they'll take nesting birds, but generally the birds are in trees, perched in trees. So their main predators are goshawks and owls, great horned owls.
Okay. So they're here anyway. All right.
Yeah.
All right, okay. Scott. Thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, how big is a goshawk? I mean, it would seem like they're about the same size.
Goshawks are pretty evil. I mean, as far as, in a good way, right?
Right.
I mean, they're just doing what they're designed to do,
you know?
But I actually don't know what they weigh. But they are a bit bigger than a spruce grouse. Spruce grouse are about a pound. Rough grouse are, pound and a half, 2 pounds they can be. And, I guess a goshawk is probably about the same. But they can fly through those trees and use speed, and those talons are so deadly. It's just instant.
Mm. Number to call here on this program is 800-348-2551. Angelina Ross is the DEC's Avian and Mammal Diversity Unit Leader in Albany. Jeremy Hurst is the Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. I'm sorry to Catherine. The cataract surgery show was yesterday. Unless, Jeremy, do you want to do anything?
Can't handle that one.
All right, fair enough. And, I got to tell you, we were driving in the Catskills, a couple of my daughters and I, last weekend, and they said, we saw a mountain lion. Now, I said, you know what? I'm doing a show this coming week, and they would tell me that you did not see a mountain lion. It didn't look like a bobcat because it didn't have spots. I was driving. I didn't see a thing. Mountain lions are huge, right?
They are. However, I'd start over. I wouldn't say you didn't see a mountain lion because I don't know. There is an small chance that they could have seen a mountain lion, but it is quite small. So it is possible but highly improbable. But you're right. Spots are not the right determination. Bobcats, particularly if you don't have a good full view of the whole animal, you may not see spots. But they do generally along their flanks, on their sides of their bellies, and on the insides of their legs have white fur with black spots. And one of the cool things about bobcats is when we do camera studies to identify bobcats, we can actually, in some cases, depending on the quality of the photo, identify individuals because they have differing spot patterns on their hips, on the insides of their legs. And so you can just detect individuals, sort of like you could do with whales and their dorsal fins or their tail fins.
I think they, with jaguars and south too, they use the spots to identify individuals.
Now, I was doing research on mountain lions because that's what dads do sometimes after the sighting or whatever it was. And there are mountain lions all over, right? That goes down from North America down into South America. And there are tons of these things, but not so many here. And we've discussed it before. Why are they no longer here, Jeremy?
Well, historically, mountain lions were viewed as a threat to livestock. And so they were removed by settlers in eastern North America as they were establishing homesteads and so on. And so for many, many years, and still currently, we don't have an established population of mountain lions here. Despite many myths and perceived sightings of mountain lions, our records show one or two cases in the last 20 to 30 years where there's been a verified mountain lion.
And they were escaped from somebody's house?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are opportunities for people to hold mountain lions illegally, bring them from some other state that they captured as a kit and brought it to the state and then release it. Or in one case, it was an animal that was an illegally held pet that was released. In another case, it was a legitimate movement of a young mountain lion from South Dakota. And that animal left tracks and scat and hair and evidence of its presence all the way through the northern tier of the United States, through southern Canada, through came down along Lake George, ended up getting hit by a car in Connecticut. So it's rare. We have mountain lions in Missouri and Illinois, and so we're within the theoretical dispersal distance. The likelihood of having a mountain lion here is exceptionally low.
We're joined by Angelina Ross and Jeremy Hurst today for the New York State DEC. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll go to Barb in Ballston Lake. Hello there, Barb.
Hey, I have no acorns. Maybe I've found five out of my three acorn trees, but the pine cones are being stripped. Is this squirrels?
Jeremy.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you might have red squirrels. You might have gray squirrels. You might have flying squirrels, chipmunks. All these animals will take the cones and pull them apart to get to the seed that's inside. And you'll see these little middens where they have piles of the debris of pine cones as they just sat in the same spot, pulled the cone apart, and you'll see the little petals of the cone. And so it very likely is the squirrels.
Okay, I've never seen this before. I might have found maybe, I don't know, a dozen or so, but this is like millions.
Oh, yeah.
My best description.
Well, keep your eyes open. I bet if you watch it long enough, you'll see the squirrels in action.
Hungry squirrels.
There's a lot of squirrels. By the way, is there any prohibition on eating squirrels if I catch a couple and we want to cook them up?
So they are a game species, and so it does require a hunting license in order to harvest them and take them.
In my own backyard.
Sure. Yeah, but they are edible, and so they can make a great pot pie.
How do they taste?
You know, people say like chicken, but I don't
think
so.
I've never had squirrel.
No?
Have you?
Yeah, sure.
You have?
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe we should do that for Food Friday. You want to come back? We'll cook up some squirrel?
We can try it.
Is it white meat?
It is a white meat.
It is.
Okay. Yeah. I don't prefer it, but if I do harvest a squirrel or one of my kids does, then we'll definitely eat it.
That's
excellent.
Good.
Yeah. That is good to know. You're on the list for Food Friday. George in Catskill, you're on.
Hi. This is George from Catskill.
Right. Hi.
Down Old King Road.
Okay.
We do have mountain lions down here. They've been seen. They're very long, about 30 inches high, with a big head and a long tail.
Anybody?
And they're very big.
Well, fantastic. And if we have evidence of mountain lions, we'd love to learn about that. And so, you know, mountain lions don't exist in a vacuum. They walk, they eat, they poop, right? All those things leave evidence for us to identify that the animal that you are seeing may be a mountain lion. And
sometimes you got a chance to take a ride down to Catskill and Old King Road and check it out.
Yeah, well since you live there, it'd be great if you can find the evidence for us, and we'd love to look at it.
Take a picture. You know, George, my daughters, even though they have their phones literally attached to them, did not take a picture of this, whatever it was, bobcat or mountain lion. But we were driving north on 9 in Hanacroy, so we're not too far from you.
Yeah, and also, Ray, we've got pheasants down here, too.
Fantastic.
Oh,
excellent. Hey, George, thank you so much. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Tell you what, Zach the engineer. Hello. We'll take a break here, and we'll hit the phones again and the email bag after this. The great Wayne Shorter on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is our number. Not a music show, though. We do love the Wayne Shorter. We're joined today by Angelina Ross and Jeremy Hurst of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. And let's grab an email or two here before we go back to the phones. This is from Kathy. Hi, we live on the east side of Lake George and have been hearing howling similar to wolves at night. It's very spooky. Any ideas what's making the noise?
You want to take it, Jeremy?
This sure.
Mammal question is thing, right?
Well, that's fine. So likely it's a dog or coyotes, and both will make, you know, loud howls, barks. However, of course, you know that we did have a verified wolf in the state a year ago. And so there is always that potential, but again, like mountain lions, it's extremely low potential. And so we don't count that out, but very likely what you heard was either a dog or a coyote.
And so they just go back to that ancestral way of doing things. I remember when I was a kid, I don't know whether they were dogs or coyotes, but fire whistle would go or a siren would go and they'd all start howling.
Oh, coyotes are notorious for doing that. Yeah.
Number here is 800-348-2551. Jeremy, take a look at this picture, and then we'll read this one real quick.
Was this your picture from your daughters?
No, my daughters didn't take a picture, which is so insane. No, this is from somebody who just wrote in, and I'll read the letter in a minute. It looks like some sort of a furry beast. Okay, so here we go.
Yeah, so the picture that came in is a small, looks like a feline, and I would hazard to guess just on the picture that it's a house cat. It's tawny in color, but it actually is representative of many of the pictures that get sent to us with people asking questions, is this a mountain lion?
That's a big house cat.
And so generally, the size needs to be put in proportion to understand that. And so when we have sightings of an animal that is questionable, that we need to understand more whether this is a legitimate sighting of a mountain lion, and again, I'll stress that we've only ever had two, is that we have these cardboard cutouts that are life-size of a mountain lion. Or we'll go to where the picture was taken and we'll restage it and put take a tape measure or use a cardboard cutout of a house cat size, and you can recreate the picture to give you better perspective as to what's there. And so this picture is difficult because it's in a grassy lawn with some higher vegetation behind, but nothing really for scale reference.
Well, I remember it was a year or two ago, you guys had a great sighting that you debunked, basically, and you had a picture on the DEC, was it your social media or on your webpage, where it was you said, okay, this was a house cat. You said it was a mountain lion, and it turned out to be very, very small. So forced perspective is a thing. This is from John. And his subject heading, bobcat versus mountain lion. I've seen two huge bobcats over 20 years. Both times, I could understand what I was seeing for a moment until I saw the bobtail. Do you know if bobcats are getting larger? And that's from John.
Well, I suspect every day they're getting a little larger. Depends on how well they're eating. So I don't think if we look back 15 years, 20 years, 100 years, bobcats are any larger now than they were at that point. So that's not really the issue. But it really is that perspective in terms of where the animal is relative to its environment and the perception of how large the animal may look. And often that bobtail is hidden. Or as bobcats walk, folks will see their leg extended out behind and think that's a tail.
Okay. A number to call here is 800-348-2551. Jeremy Hurst and Angelina Ross join us. And let's see now. We shall go to Shelburne, Massachusetts, and Lynn, you're on.
Hello.
Hi, welcome.
I really can't hear you very well, I guess.
Hello. But,
that's better.
Go ahead, you're on.
I understand that, or I may understand it, there's a preserve for wolves in Eastern Mass, but I was also informed maybe that some wolves have bred with the coyotes around here, and the hunting is somewhat different with the wolf type. But now that they can join the coyotes, but anyway, this is what I have heard. Anything you can tell me about that?
Well, I can tell you that wolves and dogs and coyotes all interbreed. And so the genetic mixture of these animals can be really challenging when you have...
Oh, I can't hardly hear you.
It can be challenging.
It can be challenging when you have populations that coexist. Now, our closest wolf population to us in New York is in southern Ontario, Algonquin Park, southern Quebec, some of the provincial parks are north of Montreal. And so we don't have an established wolf population in New York or the Northeast, but we do have coyotes. And coyotes in the Northeast have a component of their genetic makeup which is of wolf ancestry. Coyotes were, when they repopulated into the Northeast, moved through wolf territory, and there was some interbreeding, and they brought that genetic mixture with them. And so with that comes some characteristics that differentiate our Northeastern coyotes from Southwestern coyotes. There's a big difference in size, and so there's some understandable confusion there of what you might be seeing.
Are there different hunting preferences, too, for a more wolf?
Well, wolves are certainly more pack hunters than coyotes are. Wolves are larger, substantially larger than coyotes, although the eastern wolf in Canada is not that much larger than our eastern coyotes. But western wolves and Great Lakes wolves are much larger and will tend to feed on larger prey animals accordingly, like elk and moose.
All right, Lynn, thanks a lot for the call. We'll now go to Hudson. You ready for a bird call?
I would love that.
All right, let's see what happens here, Angie. Bob in Hudson, you're on.
Hi, thanks. I'm just while I was sitting here, I watched a group of starlings fly over Warren Street. And I'm just amazed at the number and how they increase in the fall. I wanted to know, do you know where they're coming from? And if you could speak to a little bit of research I did into their mammarations. Is that what it's called?
Mammarations. Can you even say that on the radio? I don't know. I have no idea.
Huh. The way they move through the air all together without running
is
into each other.
Is it murmurations?
Amazing.
Do you know, Jeremy?
Murmurations. Okay, there you go.
Is it? I don't know. It is that, right?
That's incorrect.
So yeah. I can't talk about it because I don't know what that is, but I know I've heard of it.
Okay.
I think, is it something, maybe it's something similar to how schools of fish kind of move, right? They're picking up on something, but I don't have much knowledge about it. Yeah.
Do you know where they come from, where the increased numbers come from?
That's a good question. I don't think they migrate. I think they're probably, you know, they kind of flock up in areas that are a little warmer. So they're probably hanging out together, staying warm, maybe, because it's getting cooler. I don't know, honestly. I'm just speculating.
Is that your final answer?
So, yeah, I guess so.
All right, hey, Bob, a little spoiler alert here, my friend. A week from today, Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart will be here, and it'll be all birds all day long. So if you want to, if you got a bird question, call next week at this time. All right. Thank you very much. 800-348-2551. Scott is in Middletown. Hello, Scott in Middletown.
Hello. Good afternoon, Ray, and thank you so much for having such an educational program.
Thank you.
I have a question about, I live in Orange County, New York, and to start with, in general, the guys that I used to know over the past, you know, years, they don't hunt as much as they used to. So I'm assuming that the deer population around us is increasing, and I know some communities have basically been overrun. Has there ever been any research or any studies that you know of to introduce contraceptives into a deer population to help control it?
Yeah, actually, and New York was on the vanguard of that work. We've been doing or facilitating research on contraceptive work for deer since the early 90s. And so this has been tested in a variety of environments, closed populations inside of fences, to communities, to island situations, a variety of different contraceptive approaches using different types of hormone injections to surgical sterilization, tubal ligation on males or ovarectomies on females, and so a variety of different techniques. The challenge is it requires you to handle every single animal. And in the case of the injectable birth control options, requires multiple dosing. And it's still, other than the surgical procedures, isn't 100% effective. And so the population control needs to be balanced with increased mortality as well. And so it's a real challenge for many communities to deal with these overabundant situations if they're only looking at the fertility side of the equation and not also addressing the mortality side and needing to remove some deer as well.
Very, very interesting.
And I think that some of the issue is the areas that I'm assuming are being overrun, if that's the right term. You know, they're residential areas, and the deer generationally realize that if they don't stray out of these areas, they can't be hunted. I mean, that's a yeah. learned behavior that's legitimate, correct?
Well, I'm not sure I'd go that far, but it definitely is a protective space for deer to be in an area where they're not encountering that many predators. But they're subjected to all sorts of other hazards. Vehicle mortalities are the primary source of mortality in those areas.
That's got to be the highest.
So that's an issue.
I agree with that. I see them dead all over the place.
But we're working with communities across the state, and we always have an open door to speak with others to help them address some of these issues and work with professionals to remove deer as necessary.
Scott, I believe you, though. I think it has been learned, because in our suburban neighborhood, they'll walk right up to you and say, hey, how you doing? You can't do anything. I'm going for the crabapple tree.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah. Hey, Scott.
The one thing I remember growing up in... Go ahead.
No,
thanks for your time.
No, you go ahead, man. You got one more minute.
Well, what made me think of that is I actually grew up in Sullivan County. And, you know, a couple of weeks before deer hunting season, you can just hear the rifles going off in the woods or in their yards, sighting their rifles or setting up their areas. And it seems like we would see the deer come out of the hills into the small townships, you know, or into protected areas where they couldn't be hunted. I don't know if it was just a random behavior or if it's something that they learned over generations. So,
I think that Jeremy doesn't believe you or me. But
well, so here's where I hesitate a little bit, because deer don't generally just up and move from their home in order to go somewhere else. They have an established home range, and it may be fairly large. It may be a couple miles in some cases. But when they encounter threats, be that from hunters or from increased activity in the woods just from recreationists or from construction activities, they'll relocate within that space and spend more of their time in another portion of that home range. And it may be that those deer you're seeing on the edge of the village are naturally incorporating part of the village in their home range, but during that time of year when there's more activity in the woods, they're going to find some protection in the village.
So
but they're not coming from 10
sense.
Miles away.
Yep.
All right, Scott. Hey, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it very much. Tubal ligation for deer, how is that cost effective in any way?
It's a matter of values, right? What you value.
If your vets aren't cheap, man.
True. But for folks who want to see the deer population protected and not harmed in a lethal way, that is one way to reduce the birth side of the equation. However, it is invasive. It requires surgery and can be very costly, as you say. So there's a trade-off that needs to be made in the decision process.
Does the deer need to have insurance for that?
No, but the vet does.
Well played. All right, let's go to Hillsdale. George, you're on.
Yes. We're back to bears and population control.
All right.
Back in the 70s, I don't recall any bears being in the area. And last year between August and September, there were 8 different bears spotted within a mile of the farm. Now, frankly, I consider myself to be a tree-hugging environmentalist, but I got to tell you, I hate bears, and it's out of control. I want to know why that population is, there aren't more people hunting and controlling that population.
Okay.
Yeah, so bear populations have grown in the state over the last... what you said, 70, so 50 years, right? And not just expanded in number, but their geographic range. And so your portion of the state, there weren't many bears, if any, even probably 20 years ago. Now, there's been some expansion in Massachusetts as well, but our population has grown, and it's happening for several reasons. One, we have laws in place that protect young bears and sows with cubs from harvest. And so that limits the number of bears that can be harvested by hunters and the impact that hunting can have on population control. And so we've seen bears thrive in the state. We've seen the numbers increase and distribution. And so for a farmer, certainly it can be troublesome when you have bears in the corn because they can do an extensive amount of damage. Now we have programs in place that if you have damage and need to remove some bears that are causing crop damage, we can work with you directly on that. But we've also been modifying our hunting regulations to give new opportunities for hunters to harvest bears in areas where historically we didn't have hunting seasons.
George.
Yes. Don't be a bear hater,
well,
George.
Does that include bear coming up on our deck? I'd like to feed birds, and I frankly would rather feed birds than bears. That's really a dilemma.
Sure, it is a dilemma, but it's honestly, it's one of those trade-offs that we have to make, because when bears are now in our environment, we have to choose which we would prefer, right? We can have attractants for birds, which then also attract bears. And if you choose to do that, you're going to live with the damage caused by a bear.
But we also have grills and things like that, right? And the
So living in an area where there are bears requires some adjustments. It requires us to take responsibility for our space, prevent the situations from occurring where bears will be attracted to our space. And so that requires making sure we're not putting our garbage outside before it's collected, the night before it's collected, wait till the morning of, not storing it outside, not feeding the birds when bears are active, that sort of thing.
Keep dog food inside. Don't feed your animals outside.
Yeah,
I heard your comment, Angie. You're a bear fan?
I mean, bears are just doing what bears do. Yeah. You know, any issue like that is something we're creating.
I think, Jeremy, you were on the show one day when there was a bear
in Albany.
Yeah, by the park. All right, quickly, let's go to Glens Falls. Robin, you're on.
Oh, thank you. Let's see. Well, from listening to this, first of all, I'd say that there's there are pepper wax products to apply to plants you don't want deer to eat. So I only try it once, you know.
Okay.
But anyway, my father was head of parks and recreation for several years ago. But we also owned a campground near Warrensburg on the Scroon River. And a family came up from urban New Jersey. They'd never been in the woods before, and they wanted to see true wild stuff. So I sent them to Heart Lake. And this guy told me a story where they had a campfire going. And he went to answer nature's call a little ways away from the campfire, and there's a cloud over the moon. And he looked down and he saw these like two pale green lights almost. And then the cloud went away from the moon, and it was a mountain lion, and it was like 3 feet away from this guy. Now, this guy was about 6'8". He was a big dude.
Yeah.
And it was right after Memorial Day weekend. And I figure the cat probably came down from Canada. And, he looked at it, and it looked at him, and it kind of shrugged, figuring he's too big to take, and it bounded away.
Wow.
And I told him that he saw something that I'm probably never, ever going to see in my lifetime.
You're right. I don't think I'll ever see it either.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I did see a panther in St. Mark's Wildlife Refuge in Florida one time. It just ran across the road in front of my car.
That's cool. I've never seen one.
I mean, I was spellbound by this guy. He had such intensity that I don't think he was telling me a story.
Wow. Well, that's really... Well, of course, he could have been confused, right? He never saw any wildlife before. Hey, we're done here, Robin. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call. All right. Angelina Ross, did you have fun today?
So much fun. Thank you for having me.
Really? That's the first time anyone said that. Jeremy Hirst, did you have fun today?
Always a pleasure.
It's great to have you both here. And you guys have a great website. I was mentioning it at the beginning of the show, you learned so much. I learned so much about the spruce grouse just from going to your website.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm glad
to
hear it.
Do you update that page?
We need to update it, actually. Yeah.
Well, we will see you both soon. Thanks for being here. Support comes from Studio KTM Salon, Red Hook, specializing in all phases of cut and organic color from corrective to fashion by stylist Kristen Marquette, StudioKTM.com. Oblong Books, presenting Michael Cunningham with his new novel, Day, in conversation with WAMC's Joe Donahue, November 30th at 6:30 p.m. at the White Hart Inn, Salisbury, Connecticut. Tickets required. Oblongbooks.com. Remember, don't look Joe right in the eye. Enjoy the show, but just keep your distance. At the Arkell Museum at Canajo Harry, presenting American art at the Arkell Museum, the role of the Macbeth Gallery in shaping the collection. More at arkellmuseum.org. And the Yiddish Book Center, Amherst, Massachusetts, hosting a family-friendly reading, The Mexican Dreidel, by author Ilyan Stavins, on December 3rd. Information at yiddishbookcenter.org. Thanks again for joining us. Thanks to Jeremy Hirst and Angelina Ross. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our engineer, and to Lightning Eddie Rosen for screening the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Stamps and Coins with David Tripp and Bob Scott. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.